Welcome, everyone, to the Senate Interim Committee on Education and Workforce Development. Thank you all for being here and engaging with us today. We've been working on this crusade of free community college for high school graduates for some time now. There will likely be legislation in the coming 2015 session. However, a number of Oregon school districts are in some ways out there ahead of us and trying to prepare their kids in their school district for a post-secondary education and doing it in a way that extends high school to five-year or six-year programs. I think there's probably about a dozen school districts in our state that have gone that direction. And one of those school districts has graciously joined us today to explain their thinking. And I very much appreciate Gaston High School Superintendent Dave Beasley and Susan McKenzie for joining us here today to outline their program. So thanks to both of you. Come on up. Mr. Beasley, you're finishing up your final year.
You know, I am. I have, I think, 12 days left on my contract, so this may be my last opportunity to do work like this, so I'm going to try and enjoy it.
Yeah. Go ahead and start off with your names.
I'm Dave Beasley, and I'm the superintendent of the Gaston School District.
I'm Susie McKenzie, and I'm the high school principal. Next year, the superintendent.
Okay. Great.
Well, if you look on your materials that we handed you, there's a little bookmark that I made for my staff a year or so ago, and it's a quote from Tom Vander Ark, who wrote Change Leadership. And it says, "Making systems of schools work for all kids is the most important economic development, social justice, and civil society issue of our time." And I guess the thing that's kind of happened is that our state has taken a real interest in what kids do after high school. And so we have looked at and probably copied what some of the other school districts are doing. As you mentioned, there are five or six schools that I'm aware of or districts that do that. But let me tell you a little bit about Gaston. We're on Highway 47 between Forest Grove and Yamhill. We have about 540 kids, and our campus has two buildings, one for the elementary and one for the high school. We have about 280 kids at the 7th through 12th. And a number of our students, even though we're part of Washington County, tend to be more on the economically disadvantaged side of that of the county. So this program, the concept of it, is that every district in Oregon can decide how many credits they want to have before they graduate you. Districts that have 8-period days often have 28 credits. You mandated, or the state mandated, 24 as the minimum, but there's no limit as to how many you can have. And we all know that there's a number of different kinds of diplomas. There's a modified diploma for children who are educationally challenged. There's an expanded diploma for students who can't reach the number of credits, but by virtue of some kind of handicap or another. And then there's a regular diploma. Many districts have an advanced diploma, which they award based on AP courses. So this is what we call our extended campus, which enables students to gather and garner up to 45 credits. And while they do that, we pay $4,900 in a scholarship. And what it does, it allows the student to take a fifth year before they actually graduate. And it's our response to the state's 40-20 initiative. Your goal was to have 40% of the kids who graduate earn a four-year baccalaureate degree. 40% either through an apprenticeship or a community college earn some kind of specialized training, and 20% have a high school diploma. And so this is our way of encouraging a percentage of our students who might not have the resources or the ability to enter that kind of a track. So you have to be on track to graduate and yet not receive a diploma. You have to be under 21. You have to complete the registration. You can't take federal FAFSA funds, which is kind of a shame, we think, but that still has to be the way it is. we have to agree to maintain a full-time status in an approved and accredited program, and you have to be a resident of the Gaston School District or have come on the open enrollment plan and be in attendance for the year before you do this. So, is it your turn yet?
You can do this one.
Okay. She gets to do some of these. So students enrolled in the extended campus program are subject to our discipline policies, our behavioral expectations, and with the cooperative college. And part of the money that we're going to garner from this is going to be used to have the people who will track them and do that. But they have to attend full-time during the full three successive terms. And if they won't be, we won't issue them a check for the whole thing, of course. We'll pay for the first term. If they complete it and do well, then we'll pay for the second one and so on and so forth. So that's kind of how the program works.
And how we're going to distribute that money, sorry, hope you can hear me. How we're going to distribute that money is that $3,960 will go towards tuition over the course of the year, $600 will go towards books, and $350 will go towards technology of their choice to help them prepare for college. We see the benefits of doing this, that it's a guaranteed scholarship for students to attend community college or Oregon Public University. We see it as a seamless transition from high school into the college environment with some support to help get them there. Once they're in college, they've got the academic counseling at high school, but then they also will have that at college too. And as you all know, most of the community colleges then transfer to a four-year program, so it's getting that foundation, that foot in the door. How does this affect us? And this was a difficult decision for us because there are some positive and negative effects. For the negative effects, we know that it will negatively impact our graduation rates and that on our report card, our four-year cohort graduation rates will not be what we want them to be. We're hoping that the five-year cohort rates remain real positive because this is a one-year scholarship. But the positive, in the end, we decided that the positive benefits outweighed the negative, and that is it'll help some students access college with some financial help. We believe that it helps us meet the 40-40-20 goal, and we think it benefits our particular students in our community. This, like I said, it was just approved from our board, and we have five students as of right now that plan to access this scholarship, which is about just slightly under 20% of our graduating class of seniors this year, and we're pretty excited about it. The mission at Gaston is that we're committed to helping students become successful, contributing citizens in a democratic society, and we feel that this scholarship, this extended campus program, is a way to contribute and to help meet that.
We provided you with just our board policy that we adopted, and just in case you were curious what the application form looked like. We also provided you with a copy of our brochure that we made available to our parents and our students, which if somebody in the audience was curious to look at, they could look at online. We have it posted on our webpage as well. So what questions do you have of us?
Well, I would start by saying that I think we're on the same page in terms of these kids. I mean, so let me start by saying I applaud your efforts. You and I have talked on the phone, Superintendent, and there's really not too many paths for high school graduates to find their way to the middle class without some kind of technical training, apprenticeship, community college, and I think that's at the heart of this. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yeah. But this way of doing it is taking from the K-12 pot.
Does.
Yeah, and I know you had some reluctance about that. You care to share your feelings and your process?
Well, it is kind of a difficult thing because you know, that's exactly the situation. Now, it really depends on whether your enrollment is increasing or decreasing, whether that's true. Because if you're in a declining environment with your enrollment, then it really is money out of your general fund. Gaston has enjoyed a little growth because of the open enrollment law, so this will be where those students actually will be part of the student count, so that will reduce the situation some. But here's the other thing you need to remember is that every school district in Oregon that I've ever been affiliated with has some kids who don't finish in 4 years. And those kids are always offered the opportunity. We call them super seniors or whatever, but they come back, and as long as they take enough classes and enough credits to finish, they are afforded basic school support just like everyone else. So in many respects, it's kind of like this. If the Beaverton School District did this with the students that they had, they have 39,000 students, we have 540, that would be a very difficult issue for the state to do. And I, as I told you on the phone, I think that there ought to be a process where the state of Oregon, if this is really truly our goal, figures out a way to help finance the community college programs for our kids.
Yeah, well, we're working on that. If there was a program so that your handful of graduates, what'd you say, there's
five this year so far.
So the total graduating class is about
28.
If they had, assuming they graduated, access to up to 2 years of community college at no cost to them, you wouldn't do this, I assume.
That would negate the reason to have it.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. The one advantage of doing it that way, however, would be if you went to a community college as a high school graduate, you would be eligible for federal Pell Grant.
Correct.
Right. And that's why several kids aren't accessing it, because they are getting some help in other ways, and that is more beneficial to them than this.
You know, it's interesting, and I would just give you a for instance. But if, for instance, a family had elected to not file a federal income tax form for a number of years, you wouldn't really be able to apply for financial aid, because you have to provide that kind of data. We don't require that for our program, so if that were a situation that came up, it would allow a student to continue school without having to, you know, suffer that problem.
Any questions of our Gaston team?
Yeah. How far is the nearest community college from Gaston?
Well, PCC is pretty close. They have Rock Creek, which is probably 15, 20 miles.
Okay, so easily livable for the live with the family and
absolutely
go to.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because I mean, that's from my perspective, that's one of the issues, even with the full payments. If you're in certain parts of the state, the tuition, the room and board is a lot more expensive than the tuition is. And so it's trying to figure out how to help some of those kids.
There's a campus from, or a kind of an auxiliary part of the campus for Chemeketa at McMinnville, which isn't very far. And Newburgh now has a PCC, satellite as well. So within about a 20-minute drive, you can get to three different colleges.
Okay, that's nice. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, applaud you. We're all on the same page. Hopefully, in the next couple of years, we'll have a system where this becomes moot.
Well, we certainly appreciate having the opportunity to tell our story.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Representative Comp is here to weigh in on this issue. Representative Betty Comp.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Haas and committee members. For the record, I'm Betty Comp, State Representative, House District 22. I'm a former teacher and school administrator and come before you today to share my concerns about fifth-year programs in Oregon's high schools. I'm currently a member of the Task Force on the School Funding Formula, and we have spent a great deal of time in our committee discussing equity for the schools in Oregon. I have brought with me today some data, information from the Department of Education, giving us just the basic facts about how many students are in a fifth-year program in our state. My questions revolve around equity. Are districts counting fifth-year students as full-time students or part-time students in their enrollment figures to the Department of Education? Have districts worked together and met and developed a statewide plan to support all students? how much additional funding is each district getting for a fifth-year student? How does this additional funding affect other districts that only have a fifth-year program for their special education students or students of need? How are these students identified in their enrollment figures to the department? Are these students receiving 1.0 funding, 1.5, or even possibly 2.0 ADMW? There are many questions to be answered before the legislature should support this concept of fifth-year programs. Some school districts are getting an additional shot of money at the expense of other districts. Not in the document, but what I would share is we all know that the allocation of funds is only X amount of dollars, and then it gets split out by this funding formula. I absolutely believe that new out-of-state countries, I want to make clear, who do not know English and have little academic background at the age of 14 absolutely do need an additional fifth-year school, and they need that in their high school building and their ESL programs. But when a fifth-year student only needs one credit to graduate and attends community colleges for the rest of the day, that's a problem. The school district is getting as much as $10,000 per student for the school year. It is completely unfair to districts that get just the basic ADMW of approximately $6,500 per student. Just because they have succeeded in graduating their students on time and play by the rules, they end up losing their fair share of the total funding formula. This is not equity in the final distribution, in the financial distribution of Oregon's educational dollars. The legislation needs a cost-benefit analysis that includes the impact of additional funding to community colleges before encouraging and supporting schools to adopt policy and implementing fifth-year programs in their districts. Thank you, and I'm open to questions.
Thank you, Representative. I think that's a good pushback here, and I thank the previous speaker, Superintendent Beasley, probably wouldn't disagree with you on some of the points in terms of let's have college funding and let's have K through 12 funding and have the lines of accountability. But in the absence of that, some of these schools, and it strikes me that they all tend to be small schools, are trying to do the best thing for their kids who no longer have access to a lumber mill to work at after high school. Any thoughts on that?
You will not find a person that is a stronger advocate for education than myself, particularly in this body, with the exceptions of a few of my other fellow school principals. Having lived in poverty, dealt with these issues in helping my own daughters get into a college education, I think it's absolutely needed that we address the issue that students in K-12 go to school full-time. If they have completed their college credits, let's say by their junior year, then by all means, let's look at dual credit programs. Let's figure out ways to help them be successful. But let's do it in a statewide method. I just see that this is increasing. Well, a district, you can look at the numbers. I mean, Portland Public has 399 students that are in a fifth-year program. How many thousands of dollars is that? Salem-Keizer, 281. How is that taking money away from Gaston? In essence, it takes money away out of their total allocation formula. So it's a dynamic, it's a lever that will go up and down depending upon what those allocations look like, and I think we just need to study it. I want our children to be successful, and we are looking at our 40-40-20. I helped write that vision 10 years ago.
Well, there are two kinds of fifth and sixth year high school students, my understanding. There's always going to be a need for a fifth year student.
Correct.
People don't get sick, they have difficulty. What we're talking about and what Gassman is doing, what Lebanon started, I think, was using that fifth or sixth year to get those kids community college credits and using state ADNW money to finance that, essentially is what we're talking about.
That's correct. That's very accurate.
I honestly don't fault the schools for doing it because they're trying to figure out something that probably we should have as a legislature done in the past, but we're working on now. And I do think that this community college project that we're all sort of interested in would eliminate that entire problem. But the fifth year, most of those fifth year students, I think, in Beaverton, Portland, are there not for college purposes, but for delays or problems they've had in high school and finishing.
I think you'd be surprised.
Yeah.
And the one piece that's missing out of this puzzle is the fact that when I contacted the Department of Education, they shared openly, we do not collect that disaggregated data on fifth-year seniors, so we don't know how many are in there for what reasons. And so initially, we don't have base figures to even be making good, solid recommendations. That's a concern, and that's not at any school district's fault or anything. Maybe the school districts are ahead of us on this issue.
So what I think I hear you saying is, as the Education Ways and Means co-chair, you're going to help us with this community college deal next year.
I am about equity and fairness so that all students have the same opportunity. Seriously, having worked in Woodburn School District where many of our students are like students at Gaston, they're students that are first-generation students to go on to higher education. And there's a piece that I think it's critical that we help them be successful. There's a piece that we haven't talked about. I've talked with the staff at Western Oregon University, and because their classes they're not bulging and overflowing in all their classes, they offer students in high school to enroll at Western Oregon University for $1,000 for a whole year, and they can take classes. And so we haven't even looked at, and I've been asking other university presidents as I've been meeting with them this week as in my role of the sub-co-chair, what do you do to help students get into higher education at a reasonable cost? I was surprised when I was informed what Western is doing. PSU doesn't have a program like that. When I talked to the president of PSU yesterday and I asked him. And so, again, there's things that happen in some parts of the state and not in other parts of the state. But I think we're doing a wonderful dance right now, and we just need to refine our steps and move forward. And I am more than willing to work diligently on this subject. And we are going to be talking about it again real soon in our school funding task force committee, because Senator Devlin is also engaged in talking about this subject.
Senator Roblin?
Yeah, and I guess I have strong feelings about equity as well. And my only thing is, my definition of equity is oftentimes different from a lot of people's. And I see what Gaston's doing, some of these other people are doing, as a creative way to do equity. Because equity is not giving the same amount of money to every kid. It's about giving them the same opportunity to every kid.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, if you live in some of these areas, and I include your school districts, the opportunity does not exist unless people come up with creative ways to help them get that opportunity, which does exist in metropolitan areas and other places. And so from my perspective, what education should be about is making sure every child in Oregon has the opportunity to fulfill their, what they want and their families believe is their best educational hope in the state. And that takes creative thinking sometimes, and it takes creative teachers who go the extra mile and put in extra stuff for kids to make sure that they can reach that potential that they have. And so fifth-year things to me have always been one of those things that it does take kids sometimes longer to get to the same place. And when we put time as the constraint on what people do, we are definitely not being equitable. because I have a daughter that could do it in half the time of a lot of other people, and I have another person that took, like myself, that took a lot longer than everybody else. So, you know, it is about getting to a place, not, and some people cost us a lot more money to get there than others, and so it's not about the money, in my opinion, though it comes down to the money when education and what the state's doing. But I am thankful that people are coming up with creative ways to try to help their kids have an opportunity to do the equitable things. And I appreciate your letter because I understand what you're saying, and I agree in large part with that. But I also look at some of these kids and realize without some of these things, they would never have the opportunity that all of us want them to have.
Well, and Senator Roblin, Chair Hass, I agree with you completely. As most times in our lives as a legislator here, you come at something from one direction and I come at
true.
It from another with the same outcome.
Yeah.
Because I applaud Gaston.
Right.
They're doing what they feel is absolutely best for their students, and they had to step out of the box a little bit to get there and make it work. And I just, the inequities aren't, I guess I want to be real clear, I don't see that the inequities are only just in the K-12 system. It's also in the community college and the university system. And so as our OEIB boards look at some of these issues and our state boards, we need to have a nice, smooth pathway so that everybody knows, you know, the opportunities. Because some of these schools have done a great job in creating those opportunities.
Representative, thank you for weighing in. We'll be in touch on this.
Yes, we'll continue the discussion. I thank you for your time today.
And thank you to Superintendent Beasley and Superintendent Designee McKenzie for coming down. It makes for an easy segue into our next topic. If we could call up Dr. Golden and Hilda Roselli from the Department of Education on the Accelerated Learning Committee update. Administrator Donovan, do you have a summary of where we are on this?
Yes, I do.
Senate Bill 222.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. The Accelerated Learning Committee was formed by Senate Bill 222 in 2013, and the committee was charged to examine methods to encourage and enable students to obtain college credits while still in high school, and with a particular emphasis on the alignment of funding, assessments, and procedures between high schools and post-secondary institutions of higher education, with a specific goal of making post-secondary education more affordable for families.
Welcome to both of you. Familiar faces. I'm on this task force, so it'll be interesting to hear this update of where we are.
Right. Senator Hass, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Nancy Golden, the Chief Education Officer, and
I'm Hilda Roselli, and I am the College and Career Readiness Director at the Oregon Education Investment Board.
So Senate Bill 222 gave us the Accelerated Learning Committee, and I'm just thrilled that that occurred, because what we just heard previously, we heard from Gaston, who was trying a very creative way to find a way to help kids go to college. And we also heard from Representative Comp about if we don't think of it systemically across the state, it might not create equity, and there could be a financial implication that we hadn't thought about. So I would say Senate Bill 222 is working on those issues. I think our responsibility with the Oregon Education Investment Board is a smooth pathway, really focused on transitions like the transition from high school to post-secondary, and this was a committee where we're working on that around these issues. So I want to talk a little bit about the committee and say that on this committee there were two people appointed by the President of the Senate, two people appointed by the Speaker of the House, two appointed by the Governor and the Chief Education Officer, and these are the people who were appointed. I think we've already talked about the committee administrator. Thank you. Talked about what we were really looking at with this, so we can just kind of move on from there. I think it's also important to say that, you know, we want efficiencies and we want things to be affordable for all of our families. So I want to tell you a little bit about what the committee's done so far. It's met six times. It's come up with goals and parameters.
It's studied research and other state policies. We've also consulted with people inside the state. We brought experts from other states who already have been thinking about this and maybe are a little farther along than we are. We definitely are looking through the equity lens that was adopted by the OEIB to guide our recommendations. And we have a draft concept paper which we've had out to our partners all throughout the state. We're examining the cost and potential legislative language. So I want to talk about a few of the parameters. The first one is equity, and what we want to make, this is what was talked about, Senator Roblin, you were bringing up Representative Kopp, and the folks from Gaston, is really that every child in every school district around the state should be able to, if they are ready to, meaning have the skills, get 9 college credits, and we need to make it a scale up across the state. We also know we want this to be student-focused, and we need things to be transferable. So I'll tell you, my experience as a superintendent is that some students got credit, and they thought it was going to count in a college. It's like, I've got 30 credit, and they show up at their college, and they go, well, those credits won't count here because we haven't really looked at transferability. So it's not only getting the credit, it's having the credit be used as you move into your post-secondary experience. We also have had to work very closely on issues around high school instructor qualifications. There are certain qualifications that doesn't make it as seamless as we would like for a high school instructor to teach a college class or a college professor to come on to a high school. We're staying steady around that. We're working very closely between our partners and community colleges and K-12 to have a proposal around that. And all of this is part of the committee work. We want to talk a little bit about what needs to be adjusted. Well, again, not every student has the opportunity for free college, and we need to work on that. Some students, and I think this is a really important piece of our work, some students don't see themselves as someone who can go to college because maybe they're the first generation of students who go. Maybe a lot of their families before were able to move into the world of work and jobs that no longer exist. And in high school, if they get the chance to try a college credit, all of a sudden, to try a college course, all of a sudden they see themselves as someone who could go to college. It really creates a choice for many students that they wouldn't know they had before. I think we have to really work on, this is the issue that was talked about, how do we get equitable funding, how do we acknowledge that there's some cost in K-12, there's some cost with our post-secondary partners, how do we come up with some sort of formula that really supports both of that and yet realizes that the pot is only so big. This is really the conversation around the fifth grade program and other programs like that. We know at college campuses there's a wide array of opportunities, different kinds of programs, different credits, but for some parents it's very confusing about really the different choices at different places, and it can become absolutely overwhelming. I have to say myself, when my daughter went to college, I thought I was going to need to take a leave from my job to help her get ready to apply for scholarships, to think about what college, to make sure what she had was transferable. I think it needs to, and I'm an educator, so it was probably easier for me than other people. So we really need to work hard to make sure parents can really understand this and we make it very easy for them. We need to make sure there's alignment between these curriculums. We need to make sure that if the courses are taken in high school, that most of these courses will count for the general education requirements or the career technical education coursework. We want them to be part of the Oregon transfer module. And the other thing that we need to do is that we just need to make sure that there's a consistent way of getting data. Representative Kopp talked about ODE not having the data. So when we're trying to figure out how many students take the opportunity to use these credits, Hilda is right now talking to individual districts and saying, can you tell me how many credits were here, how many credits were there? Certainly another good reason why we need to get our longitudinal data base implemented, because this should be an easy one or two-step processes. So with that, I think Hilda is going to talk through what our recommendations are.
Well, we're at an interesting point. As Dr. Golden shared, we've had the paper out now for almost a month, and we've gotten wonderful feedback from so many people in different groups and different perspectives that have really strengthened the work. We're in the process also of really getting down to the details of the funding formulas and looking at how, what is an equitable way to fund this. We also know that the committee's next step in June really has to narrow down which pieces of this concept paper really belong in a legislative bill, which pieces may be able to be handled through administrative rule changes, and perhaps what might just be some other steps that need to be taken by agencies to support this work moving forward. First of all, I wanted you to see the broad areas of the recommendations, and you all have a full copy of the paper, but I'm only going to hit a few of these. I will say that the work that the committee has done has uncovered some other areas that really need to be connected to access for coursework, and that is that every student really has to have the opportunity to look at whether or not they are college or career ready and to get college or career ready. So we're working with a lot of other work groups that are looking at this and also rethinking the way developmental education may be provided in the future as well. We also believe that, as Nancy shared, that the academic rigor of college coursework must be kept at a level that is academically rigorous and appropriate for colleges, and that students have to experience that to know that they can do it, and if they can't, what they need to do to get ready. We also, on the next slide here, as was mentioned, really have set priorities. We don't want students just taking courses for the benefit of taking classes. So it really has to be something that is going to be counted towards either a post-secondary degree or a certification. And we feel like with this opportunity that's focusing the entire state on this, we're also getting a lot more traction around the need for districts to step in and put some interventions in place that may be necessary to help students who, when they are assessed at junior, senior level, are showing that they're not ready yet for the challenge of college and career ready. So we think that long term this will save costs around our developmental education, and I mean specifically the post-secondary remedial courses. One of the things that has been brought to our attention over and over again is the importance of giving students the skill sets that are necessary to be successful as they move towards college. Many community colleges and even four-year institutions offer a course like a college success or introduction to college life, and yet some places are experimenting with this at the high school level to get those skills in place for students early on. This is where they can learn how to fill out a FAFSA form or figure out which college may be right for them or what their area of study could be someday. Under the financial provisions, we agree wholeheartedly across the board. There was 100% unanimous belief that there shouldn't be a cost to students for this piece to access minimally 9 credits, and that means the tuition, the program fees, and the textbooks. And what we've actually looked at is that in some places, and this has been proven nationally in a lot of policy analysis, that if you're funding both sides of the equation, as long as it is transparent and you've adjusted for the costs that need to be there to provide the services that the post-secondary partners are providing, you actually are saving funds in the long run around the need for students who either drop out or don't make it over to that next step. We also are very clear in talking with folks that have testified and provided us with information that there are additional costs that the post-secondary institutions incur to make this successful. This takes faculty time because the coursework must be regularly re-looked at. There has to be professional development that's shared together with the high school instructors. And there is also just that process of advising and smoothing that transition that must be considered into the funding formula. We have looked closely at a policy that the state of Ohio has adopted around how they're funding dual credit. And what we tried to illustrate in this slide is on the top of the slide. This is our current model. And one possible proposed model could be laid out at the bottom here, that state funds would still support the average daily membership of students, and that districts and their post-secondary partners would negotiate between a floor and a ceiling around those costs that need to be necessary to support the cost of the instructor, if it's coming from the post-secondary level, for the materials, the advising costs, et cetera. We also introduced a concept that there could be, right now, the post-secondary institutions receive funding whether or not the student actually completes the course or not, and yet what we're looking at is a possible way to support the districts in receiving additional funds when the student successfully completes the course. That could be a settle-up at the end of an academic year. Moving on, many of these were just best practices that have continued to surface in our review of existing programs and in the literature, that you must have a really close look at how you support the instructors. However, as Dr. Golden mentioned, we are really digging deeply into more innovative ways to look at how we certify instructors. Since Measure 5, so many of our educator prep programs moved away from a master's degree in the content area. Many of them now do a master's of arts in teaching. And so I must applaud my colleagues in OCCA, Oregon Community College Association, and both several other agencies that have worked with us to really look at ways that we may be able to take that into consideration and still be able to ensure academic rigor and qualifications that would hold up for institutions in their accreditation visits. We did also suggest that there may be a need for some one-time funds to create access to online content-based courses that could be accessible statewide. So if a high school instructor wants to pick up extra content classes, that they don't have to try to drive to one campus if they live far away and there aren't any offerings locally. Quality assurances, these are just basic good practices of ongoing professional collaboration. And what we're learning is that if there are regular reviews of the assessments that are used to authorize a student's attainment of that credit, that it's a benefit for both the high school instructors and the post-secondary partners. What we're learning even more recently from meetings that we've been having is that there's really a need to bring that to a statewide agreement about that, so that we don't have regional agreements sort of trump out and perhaps cause problems for students when they transfer to another part of the state. In terms of transparency and transferability, I would simply add that everything that we're looking at in this committee has pointed to the importance of multiple ways of sharing this information with parents and students. I've always said that we think the material is perfectly clear, but then sometimes when a student sits down, it's not clear what we mean by, oh, if you take this course, it may not transfer. So we really have to think about how we communicate that. Some places use a transfer agreement guideline that the parents receive before a student takes the class. And as was mentioned, we have identified the kinds of data and reporting that we believe legislators and other stakeholders in the state need to have relative to the output and the impact of these models towards meeting 40-40-20. So we are looking forward to our next meeting in June, and we believe that we are moving closer and closer to actually defining clear language that would be supportive of multiple options that districts could pursue, but that would indeed create an equitable access for every student, no matter where they live, throughout the state of Oregon to begin on their journey towards post-secondary education. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And that's the update on the effort to expand dual credits and make it more uniform in Oregon high schools. It's the Senate Bill 222 task force about the halfway mark. And thank you for your work. It's an outstanding chair, Dr. Golden, and an outstanding administrator, Dr. Roselli. Senator Roblin.
Thank you. And just a couple points in the presentation that I hope we can figure out a way to talk more clearly, because it created a problem here in our committee last year, and that is an understanding of what credits are. And in your presentation, you talk about 9 college credits. And is that 9 semester, 9 term? I mean, which credits are they? Number two, they equated that to 3 high school courses. And one AP history course can get you 9 to 12 college credits. So it's one course, not 3 courses. Mm-hmm. And so I would hope that we get a terminology that we can use, because it bit us one time in a conversation here when they were going to get, they had to get 27 credits. And that seems like a lot if you're looking at high school credits, when one credit is a term class, a year-long class. So if we could get a common language on that, would be really helpful so we know what we're talking about. And the other one that I liked was the idea that what we're trying to do is get to a point where there's no cost to the student. Mm-hmm. And I hope that we make sure that we think of no cost to the student in multiple ways. If a student is in your schools, and I wish we did more of this, a few years ago we really worked at pushing every school to have AP courses, and I am one of those people who thinks that's a good idea. If we do that, then it would be nice if there was no cost to the student. Right now that's $89, much cheaper than I would expect many of the other options for getting 12 credits. And so I hope we have that real conversation. And the same is true with my people like at Newport and a number of places around the state that are doing IP classes, IB classes. You can get a lot of credits through IB, a lot more than we're talking about here. And I think they are great programs. And if we could get teachers in every school district to understand that it's not insurmountable for each of them to get the training they wear, and it gets offered in a lot of different ways, so that they really understand, because I think because of the length of time they've been doing that, they do a better job than we have done in integrating what it means to have an academic course. Those teachers can kind of identify, and they can show examples of what you would have to write in an English literature. I mean, they really know that better than oftentimes our community people talk to each other forever, and they can never quite agree on what that outcome looks like. And I would hope we would learn from those experiences that have lasted for a long, long time and think about ways as we integrate this to make those still available. Because I will tell you that from my kids' experience, AP courses were the number one way. I mean, and both of them that used them took 4 years to get through their school, but they changed majors. And if they had not had those AP courses with the 27 credits and the 3 courses or whatever, they would have probably had to make up stuff at the other end of the field. And there's other things that I hope kids would learn. My youngest daughter, who was my playwright drama person, indulged me by taking calculus in high school and other classes, which I encouraged her to do. And then when she went to the university, she thanked me because she took the test at entry and she didn't have to take any math. And she didn't want to not take more courses at the school. She just didn't want to take that course. And so she didn't have to take it because she did well on the test. And so there's other than just credits, there's other ways. Hopefully we have a real robust conversation with our kids and our schools about all the kinds of opportunities that we can give them to make them ready for college and successful when they get there. And credits is one part of it. And I worry sometimes we get so intent in a particular way of doing it to try to do it the same with everybody. We lose the essence of what our high schools have done and our school systems have done better than the rest of the world with creating creative kids and thinkers and all those other kinds of stuff, because everybody's trying to amass credits again as opposed to understanding and learning. I like this report. I think it's really great, but don't leave out some of the tried to tested ways that have worked for years. And I guess I saw AP mentioned one little slide, and I saw IB mentioned in one little slide, but they have been the mainstays for a lot of kids across the state. And I will tell you that when you go to a a school that has IB, it changes the culture, and it allows kids to really have an understanding of what expectations are at the next level. And I never got there at my school, and I would love to have had IB. But
if I may, Senator Haas and Senator Roblin, I join you. I was one of those people who thought, wow, I would have loved to have been in an IB high school someday. maybe I still will someday.
Maybe someday.
however, I think one of the things that we've been really trying to do is to keep that in the mix. And because of the last legislative session, we were able to infuse around $2.6 million to pay for those test costs for AP and IB. So we're really pleased to see the results of that, that many more students are getting access to those fees being covered. So it reduces that cost. The one thing that is a little bit distinctive is that students have to wait until they take the exam, and they have to wait until they transfer to a post-secondary institution before the credit is issued. And so we call that an after-exam issuance and transfer point. So it's a little bit different, but in the 9 credits, we are definitely on that one for you.
Okay, thank you.
For your benefit.
I got a call
thank
from
you.
Our governor. So I'll be back in a moment. Thank you.
Did he almost say our little guy? Okay, no further questions. Thanks for the update. Look forward to our next get together in June.
Thank you.
Ben Cannon is here. We're going to take a quick update on where we are with the governance of our public universities and the fallout after passage of Senate Bill 270 from last session.
Great. Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I'll be brief, and I only have a couple of slides. They may be the jumping-off place for questions. So wait for this to project here. Here we go. So when we worked together in 2013 on Senate Bill 270 and House Bill 3120, we ended up with an implementation timeline for 2013, the remainder of 2013 and 2014, that looked like this. Lots of transitions underway for our universities, for community colleges, CCWD and OSAC, and the HEC. And now we've gotten towards the tail of that tail end of that transition timeline. We're approaching the July 1st date where order is restored, I suppose you could say, in the world of higher education governance. So briefly on university governing boards and Senate Bill 270, as I'm sure the commission is, the committee is aware, on July 1st of this year, the institutional boards that were appointed and Senate confirmed last year at Oregon State University, Portland State University, and University of Oregon will come fully into effect with their governing powers inherited from the State Board of Higher Education. The State Board of Higher Education, meanwhile, last month and earlier this month, approved institutional boards at our other 4 universities, Western, Oregon Tech, Southern, and Eastern. Those boards will be appointed by the governor or nominated by the governor later this summer for confirmation, presumably by the Senate in the fall, and to come into full effect in July 1st of 2015. A lot of things have occurred to make this situation possible. One is the extensive work that the university administrations have done to establish a set of agreements around how to continue to operate in a collaborative way for shared administrative services, having to do with collective bargaining, risk management, internal bank, a complex set of negotiations and understandings to ensure that even as there's a decentralization, certain core shared administrative services continue to be shared by in many cases, all 7 of the universities. Likewise, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission that I represent comes fully online in July 1st of this year with its responsibility for approving missions of our public universities, approving new programs. Academic programs are significant changes to academic programs for advising the OEIB on achievement compacts and for allocating the legislatively appropriated resources to our public universities as well as community colleges and state need-based aid and access programs. So we have those centralizing efforts, authorities retained at the state, even as certain powers and authorities are devolved to the campuses. This slide and the pink colored bars here represent the responsibilities that the PEC, the commission that I work with, assumes from the State Board of Education for community college coordination, as well as from the Oregon Student Access Commission for the Oregon Opportunity Grant and other state access programs that it has operated historically. So the State Board of Ed and OSAC are out of that work, and OSAC itself, that commission is dissolved, and its staff, along with the CCWD staff, will report to me and to the HEC. I'll note just a couple of pieces of work to sort of flag your interest for possible return to the committee in September or at your pleasure. We are, of course, the commission is, of course, in the process of developing its, working on its budget request for the governor's and ultimately your consideration for 2015-17. We're working on our proposed changes to allocating state dollars. I alluded to that authority previously, and the interest of the governor and the commission, and I think many legislators, is on allocating those dollars more along in terms of higher education completion, not just enrollment. So we'd be pleased at some later point this year to update you on that work. We have, of course, the assignments that you gave us to study and provide recommendations relative to free community college, to pay it forward, to the redesign of the Oregon Opportunity Grant, a project that was instigated or inspired by some legislative discussions, including Senator Girard's bill involving the Opportunity Grant, and has now resulted in a set of recommendations from a work group that we put together on that. We also work with an advisory committee dealing with credit for prior learning. We've launched a FAFSA completion project this spring that's increasing the number of Oregon high school students who are applying for federal financial aid. So there's a lot of work underway and a lot of potential topics to bring back to you, as I said, later this year or at the next legislative session.
Good update. Questions? Well, we gave you a lot of work in this last 18 months.
Indeed.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
We have the issue of instructional hours. I'm going to take that out of order on our agenda because Deputy Superintendent Rob Saxon is delayed at OEIB, so we will move ahead, if it's okay, with the crew from Aerosmith to come up and give us their program. Welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having us.
Whoever wants to start first and explain to us this program. It's sort of in the various stages of pilot review at some of our schools in Oregon. Identify yourself first. And
my name is Kathy Grady, and I'd like to thank Senator Haas for inviting us today, and I'd also like to thank Mr. Donovan for putting up with all my questions preparing for the hearing. Quite a few emails back and forth. Basically, I will speak about the Aerosmith program and my personal experience with that. I'll also explain that to you. Richard Boyle, sitting to my right, also has personal experience with Aerosmith, and then Dr. Terry Cassidy as a career special educator, and she'll give her opinion on the Aerosmith program. Basically, I have a 13-year-old daughter in seventh grade. She's been in special education all of her public school life since first grade. She made incremental progress using traditional special education, but her peers continued to pull away from her. In fourth grade, she began to regress, and it became clear that that bright light that her dad and I saw in her and the people that interacted with her saw was going to be extinguished if things continued the way they were going. So I looked outside of traditional education and I found the Aerosmith program. I did as much research as I could. Part of that research included reading the book Brain School, which was written by Howard Eaton, who has his master's in special education from Boston University. I had hoped he could join us today. Here, he couldn't. Basically, he was entrenched in traditional special education for years as a special educator, later as an Orton-Gillingham tutor, which is a program utilized in special education to help children that have phonemic awareness deficits. Then he opened he actually did educational assessments for families, so he was an assessor. He left all of that behind and opened an Aerosmith school in Vancouver, British Columbia, after learning about the Aerosmith program from some of his families who had enrolled their children. And he had never seen cognitive change to the degree that he had seen in these students of his. So in September 2011, my husband and I made the decision to divide our family, and my daughter and I moved to Vancouver, B.C., where she attended Howard Eaton's Aerosmith School for a year and a half. We had to leave before she was done. She needs about 3 to 4 years of Aerosmith for permanent cognitive change because we ran out of money. We basically exhausted our savings, keeping two homes between Canada and the U.S., and I wasn't able to work in Canada, being a U.S. citizen. But what I'd like to tell you now a little bit about is Aerosmith, and it's a very effective method in addressing learning disabilities. It's basically an individualized, school-based suite of 19 cognitive exercises. It identifies, targets, and strengthens the brain dysfunctions underlying learning disabilities. It actually addresses the root causes, so the problems in the brain that cause kids not to be able to read or to do math. Very different than the current special education model being utilized in public schools, in that generally they have direct instruction with reading and math, but when it comes to fluid reasoning or working memory or executive functioning, there's nothing that the current model can do to address those deficits. So children only go so far in the traditional special education model. And what I saw happen in my daughter with just a 1 year of Aerosmith, she gained 2.5 grade levels of reading skills in one academic year. That's huge. If you have any knowledge of special education, that kind of gain isn't generally made in one academic year. So she was in fifth grade, reading at a second grade level when she entered the Aerosmith school. When she left there at the end of fifth grade, she was reading at a 4.5 grade level. It was impactful. She also hated math with a passion, as does her mother and many people, but she really just didn't get it. No numeracy, no understanding that one cube represents the number one on a piece of paper. After 6 months of Aerosmith, she became Math Student of the Month, voracious for math. The third major change in my daughter, she has a severe deficit in her visual spatial world. So as an example, sending her to the neighbor's house and then expecting her to make her way home was not in her skill set. She couldn't do it. When we attended the Erasmus School in Vancouver, we got a small apartment close to the school. It was on the UBC campus, University of British Columbia campus. And towards the end of the first year, she wanted to try to... We walked to school every day. And towards the end of the first year, she wanted to do it on her own. Of course, I'm freaking out. And talked to her teachers at Eaton Aerosmith, and they said, you know, Kathy would really support her exercise called object rec, which is basically trying to recognize objects and remember them, what they look like. So we'll help you make that happen for her. And so we did it. So she walked, of course I shadowed her and she didn't know it, but she walked a half mile to and from school for the remainder of the year, and that involved crossing streets and making left and right turns. So that was a huge, huge gain for her. And the emotional impact, my final thing to say, how it's affected her, the emotional impact is huge. And you have a child that knows they're different, they're bright, they're aware, she's very self-aware, very much wants to be treated and doing the same things as her peers. So their self-esteem suffers. The psychological scarring is huge. And even if they're not bullied or picked on, they know they're different. And that's a lifelong, So I made it my mission when we ran out of money to bring Aerosmith here. And I'm not a quitter. I've been working at this since March of 2012. We formed a grassroots committee. These two people are part of that committee. We've held numerous information sessions around the Portland area, and we've raised awareness. Actually, I think we've done a pretty good job. We had the founder of the program, Barbara Aerosmith Young, speak at the Mac Club in January to a crowd of about 100 people. We have a lot of very interested families, and we do have a charter school whose board of directors has voted to implement Aerosmith in 2014. So we're making progress. We're really excited about that. what I'd like to say before I turn the mic over to Richard is many families don't have the ability or the option to do what I did, to divide their family and go to Canada and exhaust their life savings. Some families don't have a life savings. So when I decided to try to bring Aerosmith to Oregon, I decided to try to do it at a public school level. Aerosmith is offered at 55 schools around the world. 26 of those are in the United States, all private schools. And so for this charter school to be taking this on is huge, and they're going to try to make it a replicable program so that other public schools can offer it. But the burden of special education lies on the shoulders of public schools. There are maybe three schools in the Portland area for students with learning disabilities, private, tuition-based. Not all families can afford that. Faith-based schools don't have any means of supporting students with learning disabilities. So families are split up for that reason. Maybe the brother can go to the Catholic school, the sister can't because she's dyslexic or has nonverbal learning disability. So I really feel that the public school has the burden of helping these children, and that's why we're hoping that we can get some support from this committee.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Why don't we go to Mr. Boyle and hold off on questions until you're all done.
I want to start by saying thank you, Senator Haas, and the committee to allow me to share my story with you. Very similar to what Ms. Grady went through. I have two children, a 25-year-old son, who school was very easy for him. However, I have a daughter also, which school was very difficult for her. And we started in the traditional current model, early intervention, IEP, 2 years of preschool before entering the Beaverton School District and going through the special education system. Now, I want to commend the Beaverton School District and the people in that. They did everything they could, and it was very helpful. However, by second grade, my daughter still was not reading, and basically math concepts would come and go. She would have them one day, and then the next day they would be gone, and we would have to start over. So my spouse and I decided to take her out of public school and homeschool. She needed the one-on-one attention. She needed direct interactive to keep her on task. And to explain what was happening, my daughter actually has dyslexia and auditory processing problems. Therefore, the comprehension in things, be it lecture or reading or whatever, was very weak. Throughout the years, we accessed various education support systems throughout not only Beaverton School District, Alliance Charter Academy, and other institutions, to the point that come middle school, she was able to read, write. In fact, she actually published her own children's book. She could do math, and she could actually take classwork, coursework, at her current age level with her peers. However, as she got into early freshman year, even though she could do the coursework, the stress and amount of time it took her to do that was extraordinary, probably only 40 times what the typical average student would need to do homework. She would have to do that much more just to be comparable. And as parents looking and seeing that effect on her, we knew she couldn't keep up. It just wasn't going to happen. So I found the Aerosmith through this group of people here, and we actually traveled up to British Columbia to see Howard Eaton's presentation where they had their students, talk about before and after and present it. And my daughter actually identified with them and says, "Dad, I want to do this." So again, as Kathy did, we cashed out my retirement plan, and in January 6th of this year, my wife and daughter are now living up at Wildcat Lake in Kitsap County, and she's attending the Aerosmith program at Cross Point Christian Academy. Now, what the most important thing I wanted to for you to hear is that since January 6th, there is noticeable improvement. From her own words, she's saying, "Dad, I can actually do math in my head rather quickly." She says, "Guess what? I don't get lost in conversations as much." She can actually interact in conversations with her teachers, have that dialogue back and forth, and doesn't get as confused as much. So for her, she's actually excited and has told both her mom and myself that she's going back there next year. She wants to do that for as long as she can. She sees that benefit. And what I see as a parent in there is that there's been a lot of change in her brain. She is actually being able to have conversations at a high level with us without getting confused and having us repeat it. Most importantly is that we, as a family, go on hikes quite frequently. And in the past, we would have to hold her hand whenever she had to do single, stand on one leg balance, like going up a hill, hiking up a hill, or jumping on rocks. Now, at this point, when I was up there last time at Kitsap Lake, she can just scramble up rocks, no balance problems. So we know, without a doubt, that there are changes happening, and she is benefiting from them. I see that smile on her face again, and she now knows she has a future. She says, she can work hard and she can get there. And that's the major message is that some of the other educational programs out there aren't actually providing a hope or a chance. They're addressing the needs, but not enough is what I'm trying to say. So, this Aerosmith program is changing my daughter's life, and that's really what I wanted to hear from me. Thank you for your time.
Appreciate it.
Dr. Cassidy.
Dr. Cassidy.
Good afternoon. As the educator, I'd just like to provide some statistics and a little historical overview for you in terms of why I think this could be an important change in the way we educate special needs students in the state of Oregon. For the past 40-plus years, I have been involved as a special educator. In that time, I've seen many, many trends come and go. I've been involved in mainstreaming, inclusion, No Child Left Behind, the SIM, the CAM, curriculum-based measurement, reading recovery, the Common Core. You can tell I'm really, really old. And with those changes, all of those trends, though, I've never really seen any long-lasting impacts on the special needs population that we serve. When I became an assistant superintendent in Oregon 24 years ago, the special ed enrollment rate was 11%. According to Oregon's Blue Book, it is currently 14.2% and rising. Now, some people will say that increases because we've gotten better at identifying special needs kids. But identification's been in place since 1975 when Gerald Ford passed the first legislation for educating students in the mainstream. One of the primary reasons I believe that we have a woefully low number of is because we have a woefully low number of students that actually exit our special education programs in Oregon. According to the latest report that Oregon submitted to the feds, Only 9% of our 14 to 21-year-old students in special education either graduate or return to the general education population. So after being in special education for usually 9 years, because most students are identified around third grade, we are only returning or graduating less than 10% of them. Currently, we spend about $10,000 every year to educate each student in Oregon, and then provide a second weight of that same amount for each special ed student, who then has only a 90%, who has less than a 90% chance that they will ever get out of special education. When I was a special ed director, we used to tell our parents that when they signed their kids into special ed, they were signing a life sentence because they didn't get out. We weren't able to remediate the deficit areas to the point where they could then function capably in a general education environment. It's time for us to look for a different way to help our students who learn differently, but still can be helped if they have access to life-changing educational methods. There are several models that we utilize in Oregon. The most common is the resource room model, where a student will come out of a classroom for 20 minutes a week, 20 minutes at a time, maybe 2 to 3 times a week. The other one is a push-in model, where the child stays in general ed and the special ed teacher tries to help the regular ed teacher work with the student to be able to do the general education curriculum. Now, it doesn't take a scholar to understand or realize that if you want to get better at something, 20 to 40 to 60 minutes a week is not going to do it. If you want to become better at golf, if you want to play tennis better, if you want to take up a musical instrument, you need more than 40 minutes a week to do that. And if you want to learn how to read or write or calculate math, it's going to take more than a couple of 20-minute sessions a week. And currently, that's the model that we have available to our parents and families in the state of Oregon. We now know through myriad studies and research that it takes a sustained conscious intervention to make a long-lasting impression on the brain. There have been 2 recent studies just published by the Council for Exceptional Children that show that students who have sustained intervention every day for at least 1 to 2 hours will make significant progress in the way they can read or write or do calculations. While the methodology varies, the common element is that the brain is practicing cognitive skills every day for several hours and reshaping the patterns of the brain that control that academic achievement. These studies, along with the Arrowsmith studies that you have before you, hold promise for breaking that failure chain that we perpetuate in special education. Over 40 years ago, when I was attending college and was studying to become a special ed teacher, we were taught that IQ was fixed, that what you came into this world with, you went out with. You never got any better, any smarter. Thankfully, we've progressed from that idea, and we know that we can indeed change IQ, and we can increase a student's ability to learn and progress. But we also know that there has to be intentional, sustained, daily intervention with the more seriously involved students if we are going to change the way those children learn, and we have to learn how to teach them in a different way. We cannot, in good conscience, I do not believe, continue to use the same methods that we have used for years without very little visible results. The definition of insanity, as you know, is to do the same thing over and over and over again and expect different results. We need to look at programs that will provide a different method of learning for children and teaching for teachers. I used to tell people that if I really, really did my job well, as a special education teacher, that I would put myself out of work. It became apparent very early on in my career that that was not going to happen. Between the huge caseloads, the monumental required loads of paperwork, the ad infinitum required IDA meetings that I was required to attend, there was only time left to see students for a minuscule amount of time. Arrowsmith brings a new light to the conversation, a new approach, a more cost-effective model, and above all, student after student who can return to general education and make a significant and sustainable contribution to self, family, school, community, and eventually nation and the world. we hope that we can get the seed money, the awareness level at your level to start up this model program in Oregon so that we can help students claim their independence in adulthood. Your patience in hearing us out today is the first step of many to helping many, many students to fulfill that goal. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Kathy, what charter school is using Aerosmith now?
Alliance Charter Academy.
Alliance.
In Oregon City.
In Oregon City, right.
The director came and met with you.
Yeah.
Did she meet with you?
Right. Yeah.
You and Senator Roebling.
I just
want to
make sure that's the one we're talking about.
That's the one.
Yes, that's the one.
Yep.
I don't know if I don't think I said this, but I think Terry mentioned it, that Aerosmith does exit close to 80% of its students after they complete the Aerosmith program. And it's about 2 to 4 years as compared to current traditional special education, which is 9 years on average.
Well, we're trying to raise the level of awareness, therefore the necessary level of scrutiny, and get people talking about it. I'm curious to see the continued track record at the charter school. Senator Roebling?
Yeah, and we have a track record that's longer because Vancouver, Canada, had a school, and then also back east. And
I'm sorry,
these
I didn't schools,
these Aerosmith programs have been around for a while, so there is a track record. We need to look at some of that. This is the first one in Oregon, but we've also had them in B.C. Canada has probably done more.
There are 6 schools. When we left Oregon and went to Canada, there was 1 school. Now there's 6. And the reason we went to Canada was because that was the closest.
Right.
Now there are 3 schools in Washington State and 3 schools in California. And Richard's family chose to stay closer to home and go to the one near Seattle. It's growing. They actually had 14 schools sign on for Aerosmith last year, and they have 14 more signed up for next year. They say they're scalable and ready for growth, and they want to see their program available to as many kids as possible, as do we.
And the thing that I think we have to come to grips with is that this is not an academic program. It's not history, math, science, whatever.
No, it's
it
not.
Is giving the kids the tools and programming their brains to be able to take that information and use it the way others already can do it, but they have to be trained to do that. And it's the training
Absolutely.
That goes in. Now, they use regular subjects in the process because they need something to be training, but it's really the stuff behind that that's what they're about.
Exactly.
Their belief is, and apparently in a lot of these schools, that once the students have ingrained that in it, has become a part of them, then they can interpret the world themselves and do the things they need to be successful in the regular environment. And
absolutely.
I'm excited about seeing some of this kind of stuff happen in this state. I would rather it wouldn't have to always be in private schools. I mean, I would like to have the opportunity to have this in public schools. Charter schools are public, others are public. And so from my perspective, if we can find ways to help the people that are out front so that we can get the information, and if it works for a variety of kids, then maybe it's something that's transferable to other places. So I'm really happy we had this meeting. We both agreed that we would have the hearing, and I'm happy that we put that through. Here
Thank
we
you. We did give you some new information today that we didn't have the last time we met, and there are in the folder in front of you towards the back the Aerosmith Research Initiatives Report. There is research going on right now that involves longitudinal studies using standardized academic measures as well as using MRIs and taking picture of the brain so that there's a scientific confirmation that the brain is actually changing, and then there's also the academic confirmation that the brain has changed enough to increase cognitive capacities.
Okay.
That's new information that we just got in March.
Yep. Appreciate that.
Yep.
Well, thank you. Kathy and Richard, one thing that your children are blessed with is they have strong advocates as parents. So.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, I see the Deputy Superintendent of Education is in the building.
He's in the building.
And if I could call Rob Saxton and your team possibly up. This committee goes back to updating the instructional hours in school districts. Do you have a summary, Administrator Donovan?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Committee's asked Deputy Superintendent Saxton and a few parents from the Portland Parents Coalition to speak today to present as a follow-up to an informational hearing that was held in this committee during the previous session, the 2014 legislative session.
And in between there, somewhere near there in March, you had an executive order, I believe, a ruling, and we were hoping you could set the stage, give us a perspective on why that came about and what is new going forward and whether or not new legislation should be considered in the coming year.
That'd be great. Thank you, Chair House, members of the committee. For the record, Rob Saxon, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. My sincere apologies for being late. I was in front of another committee, and they asked lots of questions. So. Yes, I want to talk a little bit about instructional time and an order that recently was issued to Portland Public Schools, and then sort of there's an additional saga that goes along with that once that was done. So in October, the department received an appeal from a parent coalition of Portland Public Schools parents at the Department of Education, who we looked at the process that they'd gone through and deemed that they had gone through a process with Portland Public and that they were entitled to a review by the Department of Education. And so we conducted that review. And basically, the parent complaint had three different components. One was that students were not receiving 990 hours of instruction within the school district, and 990 hours is what is currently in rule at the high school level, that students were not receiving 130 hours of instruction for one credit, which is also in rule. And then lastly, that there was not a functioning complaint process in place in the district that would allow parents to follow that process in a logical way. And so we did contact Portland Public, conduct an investigation into what was taking place, and we had findings as a result of that. The first finding was around the 990 hours, where we said actually Portland Public does meet the 990 hour minimum, that they were not meeting the 130 hour minimum for credit, and that they did not have a complaint process in place that could be reasonably followed. And so with that, there you know, sort of became a larger discussion about instructional hours in the state. The other thing that we said within this was that, yes, even though Portland Public was delivering 990 hours of instruction, that there was a real question about whether or not students were being encouraged to take a full eight classes at the high school level. And it was that there had been communication from Portland Public earlier in the spring, before the budget situation resolved itself, that students who were juniors and seniors would only be able to take six classes, and students who were freshmen and sophomores could only take seven. Once the budget issue resolved itself and you all came up with the funding levels that eventually resulted, they rescinded that, but it was after students had already forecast for their schedules. And so we said further in the order that there is a spirit about providing 990 hours of instruction to students, and we hope that they would meet the spirit of that intent. So within that, there is a discussion to be held here about eight period schedules. And what we find is that there are a number of different schedules that high schools offer across the state. Could be five, six, seven, eight period schedules typically. And that when you take 990 hours and you fit it into components that would be divided by five periods or six or seven or eight, when you get to eight, it's really hard to offer right around the 990, in fact, I think impossible to offer 990 hours of instructional time, have an eight-period day, and meet 130 hours of hours per credit. It just, the math doesn't work in order to be able to do that. Now, Portland Public had gone to an eight-period day several years ago in an effort to reduce class size. Prior to this, they had a seven-period day. Teachers taught five periods, and they had a seven-period day. And the way that they thought about reducing class size in a five, in a seven-period day, when teachers are teaching five, you have five-sevenths. So five-sevenths of your teachers are teaching at any given time. And so you have about a 70% of your teaching staff teaching at any given time. When you go to an 8-period day and teachers teach 6, it's 6 out of 8 or 3 quarters or 0.75, 75% of your teaching staff teaching at any given time. And therefore, you can reduce class size with an 8-period schedule as compared to a 7-period schedule if your teachers teach 5. I know that's sort of a weird little computation, but it gives some context to why this was done. And so back to the sort of incongruence of 990 hours and 130 hours of instruction per credit. There are some other components to the 990 hours that I think it's important for people to understand. Within that 990 hours, 30 hours of staff development time are counted. So time when teachers are getting training, or if you have parent-teacher conferences and so forth, 30 of those hours a year count toward 990. There also are 10 hours that can be attributed to inclement weather. So if you have 2 days that you cancel, or about 2 days of school that you cancel due to snow, those times can be forgiven. And lastly, for seniors in high school, if seniors graduate early, they can be forgiven up to 30 hours. And that's within the 990 rule. When I total all that up, it's 70 hours. So a senior really only needs to have, could only need to have 920 hours of instructional time in order to meet this credit. But there's no way that a school can deliver 130 hours of instruction, at least in our current format, and have students only have 920 hours of instructional opportunity. And so I really worry that as we look at this, that there is incongruence between the 990-hour expectation and the 130-hour expectation. And therefore, we think it's important at the department that we convene a committee to take a look at this and make recommendations to the state board as we move forward about the rule that they have around 990 and 130. And to think about that, particularly in light of the fact that in the state of Oregon currently, we really have encouraged proficiency credit. And so if you can get credit by proficiency, do you need to have 130 hours of seat time to get a credit? So there is that dynamic that exists as well. I do think that as we convene a committee, we can take a hard look at whether or not 130 is appropriate, what's appropriate around the 990. Should we have these disclaimers that I identified within the 990 around, you know, inclement weather and so forth, or should there be some other kind of a more hard and fast rule? So as a result of this finding, other districts became very interested in, well, what do our instructional hours look like? And so within every year, we have districts turn in what we call Division 22 assurances. In Division 22, statute and rule, it is that districts need to comply with certain components and convey that they have complied with the various components that are within Division 22. And we call out a couple of those each year specifically to say, where are you on this? And because this instructional time became an issue, we asked districts to make sure and tell us, are you meeting 990 and are you meeting 130? And so districts have turned those in to us as of April 15, and we've begun to review those. And we have had some districts that have come forward and say, we're meeting 990, but we're not meeting 130. And so we did issue a little bit of information out to all districts, some guidance about what is required within the instructional hours. And then we also were very specific about if you were going to apply for a waiver, that you could apply for a waiver. And so that waiver would be they would need to tell us what their plan is to get to the 130 and meeting the 130 and 990. For the 15-16 school year. They would need to identify that the plan and that receiving the waiver for next school year would be in the best interest of students. And then we also asked them the question if they currently have any furlough days, because we wanted to know if there was any sort of issue about funding and reduced numbers of days and opportunities for students. Thus far, we've had 7 districts apply for waivers. I've looked at those. They've met the requirements that were set forward in the guidance. I've approved those and recommended them to the state board. Those 7 have been approved by the state board, and there are other districts who have not yet submitted a plan, and I think will be needing to ask for a waiver. There may be a few districts that are going to tell us that they still have furlough days, and we're going to have some hard decisions to make about, we have furlough days and we're not meeting 990 hours of instruction, and whether or not that can be recommended to the state board and or what action the state board would take given that set of circumstances. specifically at Portland Public. They tell us that they will have developed a 130-hour schedule that they'll turn into us by June 14th, that they have hired a complaint ombudsman who is part of their complaint process, or they're in the process of that, and that they will recommend a complaint process to the board by July 2014 for adoption, so that they'll have a robust complaint process in place, and so they would meet the conditions of the findings. So I don't know. I hope that that was very fast, because I know that we're short for time, and I wanted to leave some time to answer questions.
Well, I just have a couple. One is the disclaimer issue, whether or not teacher training should be counted in those 990 issues. And I know that's not specific to some of the controversy, but I have had some calls on that doesn't feel right. Is that done for a practical matter? Is it common throughout in other places?
Right. So what the rule says specifically is that district boards may adopt up to 30 hours of staff development time as instructional time. And so it is up to the individual district about whether or not they want to do that currently. I have not looked at what the practice is in other states, but I, too, have had a number of people say to me, I don't understand why you're counting staff development time as instructional time. We understand that staff development is important to instruction, but it seems like those are two different things. Can you think about, as you bring this group together, having a conversation about that and what recommendations you would make to the state board in regard to that sort of odd dynamic?
And lastly, for me anyway, the issue of what is necessary to do. You've been described with your order as, characterized as there's a new sheriff in town, and do we need to pass new laws to enforce some of this? Can it be done by rule? What would be your recommendation, one way or the other?
Chair Haas, yes, it currently can be done by rule, and I think it will be done by rule. I don't think that any new legislation is needed in order to enforce that. And in fact, my hope would be we need to convene this committee and make recommendations to the state board and have the state board take action prior to the upcoming legislative session, simply for the fact that many districts will already be thinking about budgets and what kind of high school schedule they're going to offer for the 2015-16 school year. And if you're going to change your schedule because there's something about the instructional time when the board comes out with a new rule that your schedule will not allow you to meet, it takes a long time to change a high school schedule and do it in a thoughtful way. And so we need to come out really with, we need to convene this group, make some recommendations, and have the board take some action in rule as quickly as possible. My other hope in that would be that they could take that rule in time for the legislature to take a look at what they did prior to the convening of the session, so that if it's not, if there are some questions about that, that the legislature would have an opportunity for review.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Senator Cruz.
Rob, I know that we got some different things in Oregon because we got some four-day schools and all that. How many states measure by hours?
Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, I don't have the exact numbers that measure by hours, but there are many that measure by hours. I know that there are many that measure by hours because when we start talking about days, there are four-day weeks, and there are different ways that people put that together. And if you start saying days only, then it really negates the opportunity to be at 4 days or to have some other kind of a different schedule that might meet your community's needs for some reason.
Unless you had different definitions of days, I'm trying to see if there's some way to be slightly more flexible. If different states that do, they measure by days, but there are definitions in those days. You have to have so much time in a day. I don't know if there's answers here. I'm just wondering if there's something slightly less complicated.
Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, one of the really great resources that we've begun to use at the Department of Ed, partially just because we've just become more aware, is the Education Council of the States, ECS. They are great researchers for us about what's in place in other states. And so we will ask ECS to do a really thorough review for us about the different ways states approach this as we convene this committee, so that we can look at hopefully all the different imaginative ways and thoughtful ways that states get to this so that we can come up with a good solution.
Principal Roebling.
Thank you. I actually believe that ours are the most flexible because you can make configurations you couldn't do otherwise. I mean, you could have a one-week class that met 8 hours a day, and you can get to your number of days. So you can do a lot of unique things, and a lot of schools did things where they had between semesters, they had a week where they took independent little classes, and they could end up getting a partial credit for those kinds of things based on the number of hours in proportion to 130. So I think the hours works really well. The issue that I would have is that I think we really have to have a conversation with people about the educational use of these multiple-day schedules. 8 periods in a day for a person like me who was ADD and dyslexic is kind of overwhelming because you got to change your brain, and it was hard enough getting it focused on one thing before they switched me to 7 other subjects in the day. And I would hope that we really have some conversations on what's the best practice with respect to how often do kids have to engage in changing their brain to go to the next subject, and is that conducive to the better understanding of the stuff and using those times wisely. So I just, you know, I know we do it for very weird reasons. I mean, we did it one time because of class sizes and all those kind of things. We just took away all prep periods during the day, so we had 100% of the teachers working 100% of the time, right. And we started an hour later, and then we just had to work to get the 309.90, which were hard, but you know, you do all sorts of weird things to kind of keep class sizes and other things. And so that's where the inflexibility comes, is when you don't have enough teachers to do the job you should be doing. And we need to make sure we fund people at a point where they have the number of teachers necessary to do the job. And once you do then you can get into having a real conversation about how many periods during a day and all those other kinds of things that happen.
And also I think if you go to 8, that you're shrinking the time and you're not getting potentially the depth in the subject matter. I mean, there's a lot of dynamics.
And you have to give up 5 minutes a period every change of time to go from one class to the next, unless you move the teacher, which is done in Europe.
Chair Haas, Senator Roebling, I agree with much of what you said. One of the really interesting dynamics for me in all of this is the 130 hours and whether or not that's even any longer appropriate.
Right.
And I hesitate to sort of enter or tip my hand when we're going to bring a group of people together and have a conversation about what's appropriate. So, but I do think that there's a lot of room for that discussion. And most of the 8-period days, and I have to commend Portland Public in this, right. They went to it for a reason, which was that they wanted to look at reducing class size. But the way that they've approached it is with sort of some of their schools are A, B, so they have 4 periods one day and 4 periods the next, so they're 90 minutes of instruction blocks. And then they also have a hybrid where some days they have multiple, so they've got a number of different schedules. But the easiest thing for Portland Public to meet the conditions of this order would have been just to say, we're going to go back to a 7-period day.
Right.
But what they found was that they had woven in some rich support programs within this 8-period day that they couldn't figure out how to get in a 7-period day. And they said, we're going to stick to this 8-period day because we think it's good for kids and we see better outcomes than we've had before.
Oh, yeah.
And we're going to, you know, think about how we can extend each period a little bit so that we can meet both components of this, including adding a couple of instructional days in their recent negotiations. So I really have to hand it to them for their commitment to the 8-period day about having better outcomes for kids in their mind.
Well, thank you for coming down and giving us that update. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Keep
talking.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good luck as we come up with these.
David Williams is smiling back there. I don't know what's going on in his mind.
We have some parents on this issue that I'd like to call forward. Lisa, Monique, and Jennifer, if you could come forward and weigh in on this issue. Thanks for your patience today.
Good afternoon, Chairman Haas and members of the committee. My name is Monique McLean, and I'm a co-owner of a commercial photography business and a parent of Grant High School students. One graduated and one a sophomore in Northeast Portland, and also with me are the two other parents that Chairman Haas just mentioned. We appreciate the committee's continued interest in the subject of instructional hours and how the extension or withdrawal of instructional time impacts students. We also would like to thank Deputy Superintendent Rob Saxton for his focus and support for more instructional time for Portland and Oregon students. This time last year, parents across Portland mobilized on behalf of high school students and calling for the restoration of access to a full academic schedule for all students. 2 years prior to that, Portland Public Schools leadership cut a deal to go to a modified high school schedule, slashing 45 teachers from seven of the district's high schools and barreling to the next school year with a system that took away the most precious thing we have to give students, time with a teacher. Upperclassmen were literally prohibited from taking a full day of academic classes, and lower classmen were warehoused in non-academic study halls. After 2 years of this mandated part-time high school, instructional time hit an all-time low in 2012 when only 17% of students in our high schools were taking full schedules. The rest carried schedules with early dismissal, late arrival, and so-called study halls. Limiting students to less than a full load of classes effectively took 21 to 43 instructional days off the school year. Because of this, parents across the city banded together to form the Parents Coalition. Due to their advocacy and work with Superintendent Smith, in 2013, the superintendent lifted the ban on taking a full day of classes and restored many teachers to our high schools. But we still have a long way to go. This year, although improved, only about 30% of students are taking a full day of classes. All PPS and PPS still lacks a framework, a timeline, and a commitment to staffing a full school day and year for Portland students who want or need it.
Good afternoon. My name is Lisa Zuniga, and I'm a production editor for HarperCollins Publishers, as well as the parent of a junior at Franklin High School, an eighth grader, and a fifth grader, also in public schools in Southeast Portland. We're appreciative.
That's a noisy house.
And a dog and two goats. We are appreciative that Deputy Superintendent Saxton focused particular attention on the 990 instructional hours a year, as it is easier to hide noncompliance with this standard, as he found Portland Public Schools was in compliance to the letter of the law, but not the spirit. Portland is the perfect example of how one can use that complicated formula to shortchange students. The stories parents and students shared with each other this past year illustrated the dramatic cultural shift the Portland School Board and PPS leadership engendered when they adopted a less-than approach to high schools. High school is a time for ramping up, but to save money, PPS understaffed its high schools so that the majority of students could only be in school part-time, and then tried to pitch this mandated time away from school as a quote-unquote opportunity for students. But the reality we learned was far different. We heard about freshmen with schedules that released them from school as early as 12:30 p.m. We heard about juniors and seniors forced to choose early release or late arrival rather than academic classes, even as they were trying to build their transcripts to be competitive in their college applications. We heard parents grappling with what it meant for their student to be in class for roughly 4 hours a day, not only in the here and now, but for all their tomorrows. Would those students be prepared for college and work? The overarching message was that education for high schoolers was a part-time endeavor, and that the 990 minimum instructional hours was not a serious state educational standard. Sleeping in and checking out were just fine with many of the adults in charge of education in Portland. While parents across the city rallied in support of access to a full schedule for every student who wanted or needed one, we discovered that the classes they were enrolled in failed to meet the minimum state requirement for instructional hours of 130. This discovery started a conversation about instructional hours that continues, and that we would encourage your education leaders to examine what constitutes an instructional hour: assemblies, professional development days, parent-teacher conferences. At one low point, parents were told by our administrators that simply having the lights on and the doors open at our schools counted as instructional hours.
Good afternoon. I'm Jennifer Tiana, engineering director, founder of a medical device startup, and parent of a grade schooler and middle schooler in Portland. I am also a graduate of the Wisconsin Public Schools, the state that has the highest high school minimum instructional hours in the country, according to that educational council that Rob Saxton mentioned. We're here today to thank Rob Saxon and the Oregon Department of Education for taking such care in accepting the complaint that was filed by parents on behalf of the Parents Coalition, for reviewing the situation in Portland, and for deciding in favor of students and their families. The ODE decision sent a strong message to students and parents about the value of instructional time. The message to school districts is that the state will step in and require corrective action if the minimums are not met. Students and parents appreciate that the state is supporting all schools offering students the minimum required amount of instructional time. We urge Director Saxton to not only enforce the minimum, but to raise the bar. In terms of what constitutes instructional hours, districts that strive for technical compliance or simply meeting the minimum shortchange students and, by extension, the entire community. We should raise the standards for our high schools and strengthen the values of our diplomas. And we would ask the legislature to examine our current instructional hour standards, assess what changes need to be made to better prepare our students for post-secondary success. If our students are going to accelerate their learning and have access to a wide variety of post-high school educational options, family wage jobs, and careers, we need to look around the country at the districts where students are doing well. High-quality instruction and more of it will be a powerful accelerator for our students. Oregon lags far behind so many other districts in the nation for minimum instructional hours. We're happy that there's concern on the part of the state to focus on this and to ultimately improve our minimum standards so that we set an example of quality education and so that Oregonians can send their kids to public schools that they trust will give them what they need to succeed in life. The best way to improve Oregon and the job market is to have well-educated students who are prepared to succeed in college and career. We will need to invest in our schools and students because the future of Oregon will only be as bright and successful as they are. Thank you. If you have questions.
Questions? These parents, very much appreciate your activism and shining a light on this. And we're already seeing some change, so we'll keep the lines of communication open. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we've cleared our agenda. Gentlemen. Thank you all. We're out before 4.
That's pretty nice.
Have a good weekend. We are adjourned.